Amen. Okay, today is going to be kind of digestion slash reflection slash assessment day. And that means this. I think it's really important for us right now, whenever things, some of you are like, hey, I see clearly, I get all this, that's great. Well, good, because we're going to in a minute get in groups and you can clarify for other people. Awesome. But some of you are going, I think I kind of see what's going on. And I want us right now to kind of take a day where we kind of establish what we think we know, what we think we don't know. And then what we'll do is we'll take this kind of evaluation again in a couple months. And then we'll kind of see where you're at then. And then we'll do it again at the end of the semester. And then hopefully you will see progress. Okay? So what we're going to do right now, this is what I want to do, is I want gospel people in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John to meet up in the far right corner. I want, let's just, right now, Pauline epistles and Hebrews. Let's, you guys over there, however, I want you guys to first get with the people that share your book. And if you're the only one with that book, then I want you to couple up with people that you have found to be close to yours. So like Ephesians, Colossians may be a good fit. You see what I mean? Are you guys following me so far? Okay. Now, what's the other ones? Okay, all the other general epistles, I want you to meet up in here. Okay? Again, pair up with your group. But, you know, like 2nd, 3rd John, you're going to be only one person with that book. So I want you to meet with the other Johannine epistle people. Does that make sense? And then Revelation, you get to hop in wherever you want. This is what you're going to do, though. Hold on, don't move yet. I want you guys, we're going to take 10 minutes or so. And what I want you to do is, and that's why the smaller the groups, the better, because there will actually be meaningful conversations in this. I want you to talk about Empire Studies' impact on your book. What you have discovered. Maybe there's a passage where you said, actually, I'm reading this one differently. Or you can say, I'm not really clear. And I want you guys to help clarify each other, both what you're doing in your particular books or on Empire Studies as a whole. And we're going to take 10 minutes. Then what we're going to do is we're going to come back and we're going to discuss what you guys talked about as a class, so because you're not going to be able to hear everybody's conversation. Then we're going to go through the extra credit, some of the pictures that you guys got. I threw a couple up there myself to once again show how Empire Studies impacts. And I'm laying this all out for you. That way you know kind of what's happening. Tomorrow we will dive deep for the next 2 to 3 days into the Roman history. Well, we're going to start with the geographical, mythological, and historical origins of Rome. Go through the Republic. Then we'll hit the shift into the Principate. And then I will have you guys help dialogue with me about the emperors themselves and the impact that they had on the society. And then we'll move into Roman society, which means your oral exams will not be next week. I'm letting you know that right now. They're going to be the following week. Okay? So next week, and primarily because I found a major mistake on the syllabus, where even though this class isn't affected, I put Faith Forum for your class next week on the Wednesday. And I take the syllabus as kind of my binding contract to you, where I can take things away from it, but I can't add to it. So I'm not going to require you to be in class next Wednesday, even though this hour won't be affected, because I put it on the syllabus. Which annoyed me, but you know what? I'm a man of my word, and that's what's going to happen. So, next week we will have 3 days still to really hammer on some stuff. And the following week we will do the oral exams after the Jewish discussion, which will set us up for the historical Jesus and his new perspectives and your guys' presentations and all that stuff. Any questions about where the class is headed? Okay, go ahead and move to your locations right now. Gospels up there, Pauline epistles back there, General up here, and Revelation can meander in between. Okay, let's start wrapping up the conversations. I guess you don't need to return to your seats. If you don't have a seat, obviously go ahead and find one. Unless you want to return to your seat, you can, that's fine. But I want to hear, though, what you guys are talking about. What are some of the things that are coming up in your group as far as Empire Studies impacting your book and things of that nature? Anybody, raise your hand or just yell out, whatever. You guys were just talking for 13 minutes, so I know hopefully there was something that you could report, right? Yes? No?
We found a precious jewel in Colossians.
Okay, tell us about the precious jewel.
Ephesians too.
Okay.
Ephesians as well. Talked about,
Hold on, let's listen up.
Or just submission in the household in general. But then slaves obey earthly masters and everything. And do it not only when their eyes on you and to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart. Reverence for mm-hmm. because, you know, the bow down deeply, silently part. Mm-hmm. It's, don't do that. Like, God's not that type of ruler. Like, when you submit to him, it needs to be a sincere submission and not just when.
Absolutely. And we're also, whenever we get into Roman society, it'll have a lot to say with the patron-client relationships and the way in which slaves interact with their masters because of the Roman society. We'll have a lot to say about that passage too, but that's a good one. That's a real good one. There's a hidden transcript within the hidden transcripts that's undermining some other people's hidden transcripts. That's awesome. Job well done. What else? Gospel people. How do you see empire studies interacting with the Gospels? Let's get one from each. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I have Mark. With Vespasian, there is miracles that happen, like healing the blind and lame.
Yeah.
With him and a lot of elders, and just having to show that he's like the true guy, the real emperor coming in. Especially with the healing, it just matches.
Yeah. So I'm assuming then that you're dating Mark to around 69-70, whenever Vespasian would be arriving. Because you're exactly right. We have, matter of fact, what's interesting with Matthew's account, the healing that Vespasian supposedly does, which I'm sure, I don't know if you've read the passage where Vespasian does do the healing, but you have a shriveled hand, you have a blind person, and a lame man all in a row. They all come to him, to Vespasian. And what he basically does, he goes back to his doctors and he asks them, like, okay, now, can I do this? Because if they come to me in public and I can't do it, that's a problem. Basically, they tell him with the shriveled, I forgot what they do with the lame man, but with the shriveled hand, they tell him, just go and step on his hand and it'll be fine. He goes, steps on a hand and it stretches out, the guy's good. The guy that's blind, they tell him just to wipe away the junk in his eyes with this water. He does and he's healed. And he basically goes around saying, see, I'm a healer too. I'm therefore the divine emperor. And what you have is Jesus and Matthew, the exact same sequence of miracles occurs in Matthew. And I mean, with the shriveled hand, the paralytic, and the blind man. And as a result of that, you almost see this direct speak from the Gospel of Matthew looking at Vespasian going, no, I really am. I don't have to do any weird little tricks like you're doing either. Yeah, absolutely. That's a good one. What else? Let's see. We heard from Mark. Who else we got? We got either Luke, John, or Matthew. Yeah. You can't repeat what I just said, by the way. I'm just kidding.
But I got Galba and Otho. And one thing, we talk about a few things, but one thing I did notice that he spent a great deal of time dealing with their deaths, the account of how they died. And even though there was a lot of auspicious signs going on, like at the beginning, like temples being struck by thunder and all the heads falling off of the statues and stuff, there's like no, like hens died. That was a big sign. There was a lot of detail, like what was said, what soldiers were running around where, why certain soldiers couldn't find him because they were from Germany, so they didn't know the layout of the city, and the manner in which, like, when Galba was executed, he was killed by these soldiers, but then another soldier came up and, like, actually cut his head off and was going to carry it to Otho. But because Galba was 70, he had no hair. And it makes a point to say that he couldn't hold him by the hair. He could, like, wrap it up in his garments, and that didn't work. So he ended up, like, using his thumb and sticking it in his mouth. And it's like all these... And then Otho has this very heroic death. And there's so much detail on, like, what is said and the character. Like, it's just more detail. It's like a different type of literature during those times.
So how did you see that impacting then the description of the death of Jesus in Matthew?
Just that you can, that during that time period, authors were more careful about things like death.
Okay.
Where they might be willing to kind of, you know, punt to omens and auspicious signs on certain things. They would definitely be more concerned, because the way that someone died tells us about how they lived.
Ah, there you go. That's the connection. That's exactly right. And that's a good connection. That's an important one, because Jesus died in one of the most shameful ways you can possibly die. And the gospel accounts are very meticulous in making sure we understand that. And so from a Roman's perspective, that's strange. Because Galba and Otho is not somebody that they still looked back to the glory days on, even though they were quite short anyway. Regardless, the way they died, you're right. had something, if they wouldn't have died that way if they were truly the agents of the gods. Even though they referred to them as gods, in the sense that they were the king or the emperors, compare that death to the death of Augustus, and there's a drastic difference. Absolutely. What else?
I did John.
Mm-hmm.
And so I dated into Domitian, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing about Domitian is a lot of times he claims being a deity,
mm-hmm.
and he's the emperor, and he just has a better view of himself than what he really is.
Yeah. And Suetonius brings that out.
Yeah.
In chapter 13.
I guess I've just noticed, just real quick, read through the Gospel of John a little bit, is John a lot of times focuses on the deity of Christ a lot of times, especially in the first chapter, establishing that. And then actually, I'm teaching at Sunday school, and after the feeding of the 5,000, I thought they wanted to put him up as a king,
mm-hmm.
you know, which was interesting because I made this connection that even the people aren't even liking Domitian. They're wanting to raise someone else up as king,
mm-hmm.
Put him in power instead.
Yeah, and what does Jesus do to that suggestion? Yeah, he says, that is not who I am. You want me to be like the kings of the earth, but I'm not. There's also an interesting connection at the resurrection of Jesus with Thomas. Thomas finally, you know, looks at Jesus' resurrected body, he bows down, and what does he say? I think it's 20:28. What does he say? What's his words? My Lord and my God. And Suetonius, Domitian 13, says whether you're writing to Domitian or you're speaking to him in word, you're supposed to refer to him as our Kyrios and our Theos. I don't think that's an accident. Same thing with Revelation chapter 4, whenever the one seated on the throne by the 24 elders, they cry out, our Lord and our God. If both of those are written in the time of Domitian, that may be saying something about a commentary of the way in which the kingdoms of the world and the kingdoms of heaven are clashing. Sorry. Come up with another one. There's tons of them. let's see. We're only missing, what, Luke? Luke. What have you noticed with Empire Studies in Luke?
We did Luke and it was narrow. And just, like, looking at that, I'm having a hard time right now figuring out how that works together. But he just seemed like he was searching for the approval of people a lot.
Hmm.
Maybe just how that relates to Jesus was searching for that. He was going against a lot of times what the people wanted. Nero was always giving gifts.
Yeah, what you're tapping into is what we'll talk about even more in detail next week, and that's the honor-shame society. Absolutely right. And Nero was very insecure with his honor and shame, and it has to do with how he came to power. He comes to power at, what, 17, 18 years old? Having no military experience at all whatsoever? How many people are going to want to follow this commander-in-chief of the empire when he's 18 years old and has barely stepped foot on any sort of battleground at all? He's very insecure. So he had to accumulate honor in a much different way. In their society, honor and shame is what rises and falls. Your reputation, your influence is built on that. And if you're the emperor and no one really respects your honor because of what you haven't done, you've got to figure out ways to do it otherwise. And Jesus, like you said, comes along and he's just not really concerned with that game. He will do stuff like touch lepers, which makes him very shameful. And he doesn't care because that's not you, what you're noticing is even a contrast between the value, what the kingdom's value. Our kingdom values something different than the kingdoms of the world. And what you will see in Suetonius with Nero, what he is pursuing, is not what you will see in the Gospels of Jesus pursuing. It's different. So there's a conflation of the kingdoms, and there's also a key distinction of the kingdoms all at the same time, interacting in Empire Studies. Okay, Pauline people. We're not going to go through every single book of Paul, but just some of the highlights. Yeah, Si.
I mean, one of the obvious ones in 1 Thessalonians 5, the peace and the safety. People are saying peace and safety. Destruction and stuff. And with reading about Claudius, the fact that he was like the first emperor to go to Britain and to get part of them, it seems like the kingdom was expanding and it was kind of a good place. But then also it was interesting, like in chapter 2 of 1 Thessalonians, it says the day of the coming wrath. And I don't know if the empire kind of thought that things were they saw that on the outside it looked really good, but on the inside they all thought Claudius was a buffoon and didn't know if they'd be like, really things are getting ready to fall apart. Like when he became emperor, his like sister was like, oh no, they're now the fall of Rome.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was kind of the tension that was going on the outside. It seemed like there was this peace and safety, but then on the inside really just emperor seemed like it.
So what you're even describing there is the hidden transcripts of the Roman people versus the public transcript of Claudius coming to reign. He comes to reign and they're going, well, he's better than Caligula, who was a psycho. But this guy, do you think he's going to lead us into a golden age? And yet to his face, they'd be like, oh, Claudius. Matter of fact, we'll even see a coin in a minute that's meant, a coin in a minute that is minted with divine Claudius Augustus. So to his face, the public transcript is very clear how you're supposed to treat him. But behind the scenes, it's totally different. And if you have 1 Thessalonians 2 talking about the coming day of the wrath, you don't want to be the president that's reigning whenever wrath comes because of something that you have done. You don't. Because it could say something about your... Well, for example, in the Roman time, it would be an omen about who is leading. In our time, it's just how you respond to that particular disaster is how will define your presidency, and you'll always have something negative coming at you. I do want to make sure everybody understands we're talking about 1 Thessalonians 5, though. 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 and following says, about date and times, we don't need to tell you about the coming of Jesus because it comes like a day, like a thief in the night. He says, in fact, when people are saying peace and security, pax et securitas, suddenly destruction will come upon them. That's a big Empire Studies passage. Okay, other Pauline stuff. Elijah.
Just for the book of Romans specifically, they were, like he said that, you know, Claudius took over Britain and Nero lost 2 cities in Britain.
So, yeah.
as like a switch in emperors, it was like, no, like everyone thought that, I mean, first off, Nero barely ran that empire by himself. He ran by his mother and then like the Bureau or whatever. So the entire, like, I feel like the entire, I don't know for sure, but something to like how the, you know, the, I guess the Romans specifically like interpreted his reign, but I think it seems like they hated him for the most part is what I can tell. And by losing, you know, wars and by losing battles, it seemed like at least they probably felt a sense of less security, especially, and it was interesting just from the Romans being in about, you know, first off, like with condemnation and, you know, understanding God's wrath toward, first off, the wickedness of what the Romans practiced, especially as Nero being a leader and practicing, you know, like what he did, like, you know, just the things he did. Like, I mean, like I said, he didn't run the empire. He basically, like, it said that what I was reading in Dio, it said that he, like, no one ever told him that what he was doing was wrong, so he just kept doing worse and worse things until, you know, like, until it got so bad he ended up burning down them. So, it was just interesting to see just how, like, how Romans talks about righteousness and justice being, you know, carried out through, you know, Christ and stuff like that, and then the opposite side of that being Nero being the empire of who should be carrying out justice and being righteous, and yet was totally distorted by his own perversion.
Absolutely. He was pretty much the antithesis of... And what's interesting is justice and even righteousness as far as... I mean, obviously they're going to be defined different. But those terms will come up in some of the Roman attributes that are good for an emperor to have. They're the moral characteristics that they need to have to reign well. But you see those coming up in Romans, but I think they're being redefined by the covenant of the Old Testament. Of course, that's more New Perspective talk, which we'll get to later. But you're exactly right. There is a contrast that's playing on there. And the fact that he, in chapter 13, he kind of comes to a point where he's actually bringing up the whole government issues that have been laying underneath this is something that would make you say, and he's writing to Roman people in the city in which, enshrined in the city, which would make, you know, the peace of Jesus Christ in the city of Rome is a much different statement than the peace of Jesus Christ in Spain. Because when you're in the heartbeat of the place that's claiming to be the source of pox, the word arena, it's going to carry a different connotation. Absolutely. Yeah, what else? I saw a couple more hands. Yeah, Bryce.
Just noticing Galatians 4, it's talking about the heir is subject to guardians and trustees until it's held up by his father. And it goes on and says that we might receive adoption of sonship.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. And so it's the process of emperors, you know, being adopted by
Yeah.
And then the new guardian, especially Claudius, had a guardian he didn't like, and that so I don't know the explicit connection there.
Oh, there definitely is.
He talks about, you know, and that Claudius wasn't adopted by anybody because everybody thought he was an idiot, and so he was actually proclaimed emperor by the Praetorian, not by adoption. And so I thought that was interesting that, you know, here Paul is saying we're going to receive adoption, we had a guardian, we're going through this process that even our own emperor didn't go through.
Absolutely. No, that's really good. Hannah.
We have 2 Corinthians, Audrey and I, and she mm-hmm. pointed out in chapter 2 where it says, thanks be to God who leads us in triumphant procession. Hmm. Like, and just seeing, like, knowing that normally it's the leader, the emperor, who would lead in triumphant procession. And so people following him are, like, worshiping him almost and being led by him. And so when Paul says that God leads us in triumphant procession, it's almost like a subversion of.
Absolutely. Yeah, which actually, that's one of the only 2 times the word triumbeo, the word for triumph, or the typical word, Greek word for Roman triumph is used. It's only used twice, 2 Corinthians and Colossians. And that is not something to bat an eye at. That's significant. You're exactly right. And who is leading the triumph? In Colossians, it'll get even crazier. We're not where Colossians are, we're not where we're at. But whenever Jesus' crucifixion is the triumph. You're going, what? Like, how could that be? And yet, that's the whole point. Okay, any more else from Paul before I move on to general epistles? Good. Drew, I'm not going to let you get away without Philippians talk, but we'll get to that in a bit. Okay, general epistles. What do we got? What have you guys see interacting with? Am I in the right area? Okay. Yes, general epistles. How do you see in some of your books the impact of the empire studies? Or do you? See. Yeah.
I saw in 2 Peter, he talks a lot about the world being destroyed by fire.
Mm-hmm.
And Nero burned Rome to rebuild his own stuff. So it's almost, it could be an allusion to that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that'll eventually even become a typical apocalyptic symbol that's used for the new heavens and new earth. But whenever 2 Peter is being written, and if it's written in the time of Nero, they just had, 40% of the empire, or the city, the key city, destroyed in order to be rebuilt. Yeah, absolutely. What else? Yeah, Charlie.
3 John says, mm-hmm. Well, there's not like a lot of imagery, but I feel like some of the shame and honor stuff that you're talking about mm-hmm. is going to impact a lot more about, like who is accepting who in the church and what's going on in the situation.
Yeah, that's one of the things. I've made sure that even in the smaller books, I've read through all of them, and there's empire studies in all of them. That way I didn't leave you guys out to dry. But 2nd and 3rd John and Philemon especially, honor, shame, patron-client stuff that we'll be talking about next week are huge in those books, especially Philemon. Hello? He's saying, excuse me, Philemon, you're a Christian because of me. Therefore, you owe me huge. I'm not going to collect on that debt, but here comes Onesimus, and, well, I'll let you decide what you should do. There's some honor shame going on there that's very subversive. There's a hidden transcript that's being brought into the public transcript as a way of pushing him towards what he knows he needs to do. But 2nd and 3rd John as well. Man, honor shame with the relationships between the people. Oh yeah, that's going to be huge. Revelation is lobbed in the middle here. What did you find?
Well, yeah.
I'll say, you're on the spot, friend.
Well,
I will pin you to the wall. No, I'm just kidding.
I don't want to talk like... of course, John using the phrase "Our Lord and our God" for God. And,
mm-hmm.
It seems like at the time there was a lot of imperial call being forced on Christians. It was just now starting to get really starting to be practiced and starting to have kill Christians for denying it. And so it seems like John was warning the Christians, there's going to be these trials and stuff coming. You're going to be told to worship the beast. And you have to understand that we have our Lord God.
Yeah. This is something interesting about the imperial cult. The imperial cult usually amps up with an emperor that's insecure about his militaristic contribution to the kingdom, to the empire. It really amps up with Caligula, who was known as Little Boots. He traveled around with that was what the word Caligula means, because his father was a great, great Roman military general. And he traveled around with the army. And the army people gave him the nickname Little Boots, because he was the one that would tag along with the boots, wanting to be like the army guys, but never really actually was. When he comes to power, he was always in the shadow of his father. And he felt very insecure, and the imperial cult for the very first time becomes something that's really pushed on people. Then the imperial cult amps up again once again with Nero. Nero being very insecure because he's only 18 years old, never really accomplished much, and he has to kind of push on people to kind of make a reputation for himself. In Domitian, we find the same thing. Because Vespasian and Titus, were his dad and his brother, were the two key generals in destroying the temple in Jerusalem. And Domitian was too young to even be a part of that. And no really significant wars that he didn't really have to start with, except for the Dacians and Germanicus, Germania, did Domitian really fight. And even those, he wasn't the one that was fighting them. And that's when you see the imperial cult being pushed as well. Usually insecurity leads to irrationality. And that's just kind of a general principle in, you know, around here too. Usually when people are the most irrational, whenever you interact with them just on campus, it's probably because they're the most insecure. And they're trying to make up for something by doing stuff that's just rash and ridiculous. Emperors are not impermeable to that. Same concept.
Mm-hmm. Something else I found was that off of that same kind of thing, the imagery of Jesus riding on the single white horse,
mm-hmm.
That same image was in Suetonius, except it was when Domitian was young and he was riding in a victory on a battle he didn't fight.
Exactly. And who was the victory for? His dad and his brother in 71. And Domitian is riding on a single white horse next to the ones that are actually the triumphing generals, which I think impacts Revelation 19 through 20. I want to do another Revelation one based on one of the coins one of you guys submitted. This is a coin of Nero. If you look around the side, the sheet said it's Emperor Nero is what this IMP would be, but that's actually it's Imperator, which is general or a triumphant general is more what that word would mean. Imperator Nero, Claudius, which he's pointing to his genealogy, even though he was adopted, Caesar, and then you have Augustus, and then down here where the words or the letters start to scramble together, you have it assert three things about him: Pontus Maximus, which means high priest. And the Tribunican, which is it's a type of consul that was around, and we'll get to that tomorrow, around in the Republican time. And then also father of our country. Now, what's significant to me, though, for Revelation, is what's on the back. What's on the back, what is written, what's on the back here, it's written around the sides, is having borne peace throughout the land and sea, closed the temple of Janus. All the way back to the time of Augustus, the Temple of Janus was a temple in Rome that whenever peace and security reigned the land, they would close the doors because the wartime was over. So whenever war would happen, so the story goes, whether or not they did this every time is about impossible to pin down, they would open the doors. But it was more of a political symbol than it was a political reality, because there were always wars or uprisings being fought by Rome. And yet, a very, very political thing to do is to say, the temple doors of Janus are closed. What we have here is we have Nero on his coin with the temple of Janus and the doors closed. What is he saying about his reign? Look what I've accomplished. We are at peace. Now, let me read to you something I find interesting in Revelation chapter 15, because he doesn't need to add this detail. And frankly, from the Old Testament, all perspectives, this detail is kind of weird. Revelation 15:5, after the song of Moses. 15:5 says, after this, I, John, looked, and in heaven the temple, that is the tabernacle of the testimony, was opened. What is he saying? What? It's wartime. And what happens right after that? The pouring out of the seven bowls on the earth, one of them actually on the throne of the kingdoms of the world. So the very fact that he says the throne or the temple is open, you're going, okay, that's a weird detail, thanks. But if you understand some of the, and this isn't the only place where the temple of Janus comes up, by the way, with Nero. We'll even see in a minute that, oh no, actually we won't see. It was what I was looking at last night, some coins. Claudius has the temple of Janus on his coins, closed. Domitian, closed. It was a key symbol, like Roman triumphs, of saying, look what I've done. Now we're going to go through some of these pretty quickly. If I've skipped over you, don't. No, before we go over there, let me do this. First of all, Drew, talk about what you found in Philippians, and then I want to add something.
Yeah. In Roman society, you have a bunch of Roman emperors grasping at being the rule of God.
Mm-hmm.
And in Philippians 2, you have the Christ and whether it's true or not. But Jesus, who did not consider equality of God something to be grasped. And so you have Jesus being set up kind of in contrast to the emperors at the time who are grasping to God, Jesus would grasp at it. And the method is interesting because the method of the emperors displaying their dominance was the cross, and that was Jesus' very method of displaying his who he was.
Exactly. Well, and what's interesting about this insight too is that you're putting the political programs of the kingdoms of the world and the kingdom of Christ next to each other and saying they are antithetical. What they pursue, we don't. How they pursue it, we don't. And you even pointed out when we were talking up here before that Philippians 1 also has the talk of being citizens of the kingdom. And it even uses the very word when it says conduct yourselves in a worthy manner. That very word is politic, where we get the English word politics. So in the context of Philippians 1, it's political and it moves right into Philippians 2. And we think all of a sudden now he's moved to just this Christology text that's only reserved for theology. And yet he's using political language in order to describe the theology that now impacts how we live. And this was one of the questions that, and it was a good question that Cy came up to me afterwards, after last class, and he just said, how does this impact my teaching in the church? It virtually was the question. In other words, he was saying, how do I explain hidden transcripts and stuff like that to the people that are sitting in my Sunday school? And that should be the question you're asking. And here's my response. You don't. But you use it as interpretation all the time. I don't know how many times that I've explained the Roman triumphal procession imagery that I think impacts Revelation 27 through 10. And people at the end of it aren't going, okay, now what? I never even used the word hidden transcript. What do I do? I give them the interpretation and it opens up a whole new world for them. And they start asking different questions. Because ultimately what my goal is in teaching is to nudge people towards the right questions they need to be asking that they may not be asking. I'm not going to give them the conclusions. That's not the point of me teaching. My point is to guide them in the direction that they will start asking the right things and interacting with the world in the right way. That's my goal. That's always my goal. I will never have a lesson in the local church on hidden transcripts like we talked about with James C. Scott. Why? They can't handle that. That's not the point. The point is, you guys can handle it. And you guys need to have that structure in place so that then it can impact your interpretations that you then give to the people. That's the point. You are training to be leaders in a church. Therefore, you're going to have way more quiver or way more arrows in your quiver than you're actually going to be shooting on any given Sunday. You're supposed to anyway. Which is one of the reasons why lifelong learning is an important thing as well. Just a little plug, moving on. Point is this. How do you impact your church with this? Use it to inform your interpretations and then allow it to open them up to a whole new world. Like Philippians 2. All of a sudden now the conflation of, is this Adamic Christology? Is this, you know, high Christology? All of a sudden it's going, yes, it does have implications on both of those. But the imperial Christology, or the imperial theology that you add into that, adds a whole new element. Whenever people may start saying, so where should my allegiances primarily be? The church. First Peter, he calls us a nation, a holy nation. That has some political impact. You don't claim to be a nation that is an unsanctioned nation that's ruled by another king in another kingdom whenever you're living inside of a kingdom right now. The application will follow, and a lot of times I never even give the application. I just lead them to the edge and say, now you figure out where to jump. So how do you use this in the church? You don't ever mention the word hidden transcript, but you use it all the time to show them how the biblical world opens up to them. A couple of things really quick. I think we're down to like 1 minute or over. Never mind. We'll just go through this really quick next time. It's not very much. I just wanted to point out some of the key symbols you guys brought up. But we'll dive in deep to Roman history tomorrow. Love you guys. See you then.